So I'll invite you to grab your Bibles, and you can turn to the book of Habakkuk. So it's not Habakkuk. You have to act like you're trying to spit something up. And I know, don't actually do it because then you're spreading germs. But Habakkuk is how this book is titled. And so Habakkuk is the eighth minor prophet in the Old Testament. And so what we're going to do is spend the next 3 weeks walking through what is a very interesting book of the Bible. I would say that the book of Habakkuk is probably one of the most interesting books in the Old Testament. And here's why. The book of Habakkuk is unlike any other prophetic book that we have in the Bible. It's actually quite unusual. Habakkuk, as a prophet, in this book that we have, he actually never once addresses the people of Judah directly, and we know from other prophetic books, oftentimes the prophets would stand up and go, you know, thus says the Lord to you, Israel, or to you, Judah. That never happens in Habakkuk. Habakkuk is a back and forth dialogue between the prophet and God. What we see in this book is Habakkuk complaining to God, and then God answering his questions and his complaints. That is why this book is so unique. Most prophets would stand up and proclaim divine judgment, and the book of Habakkuk is him pleading that God would send divine judgment. Most prophets, like Hosea and Joel and Amos and Obadiah and Micah and Nahum, all of those prophets just accepted the words of God and his deeds almost uncritically. And Habakkuk, however, questions God's decisions. Habakkuk asks questions like this: why is there so much oppression? Why is there so much injustice? Why do evil men prosper? Why do righteous people suffer? Why doesn't God do something about it? Like, has anyone ever asked those questions before? I have. Why is there so much evil and suffering and injustice in the world? So take heart, because centuries ago, a prophet named Habakkuk asked the exact same questions that we ask today. So I'm very excited to dive into this book. So Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1, it begins this way. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. So there's the inscription, right? Most prophetic books, they start with this inscription, you know, the prophet so-and-so, and usually it's son of so-and-so who prophesied during the reigns of, you know, this king or that king. But what we have here is a very short inscription, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. That's all we get. So we want to ask, you know, who was this man and when was this book written? Because that'll help us understand actually the rest of the book. So besides what we have here, we actually know nothing about this prophet. There's no Habakkuk is not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. All that we know about him is what we have in this three-chapter book of ours. We know he was a prophet because verse 1 tells us that, Habakkuk the prophet. So we know he was a prophet, but that's kind of it. The rest is all speculation. Now, here's what's really interesting. There's actually quite a bit of what I would call like fan fiction written about Habakkuk. There are a lot of myths about who this guy was and what he did. So for instance, there's some Jewish texts that are not in our Old Testament, and they say that Habakkuk actually came and visited Daniel in the lion's den. So there is a Jewish writing that says that an angel came and grabbed Habakkuk by the hair and brought him into the lion's den, and then Habakkuk brought a bowl of stew to Daniel. I mean, that's interesting, but that's just not anywhere in the Bible, and so we're pretty confident that actually didn't happen. Another myth is that Habakkuk was the Shunammite's son. If you remember that story in 2 Kings 4, Elisha says, you know, you're going to have a son, and then he raises that son from the dead. And so many people read 2 Kings 4:16, where Elisha tells the widow, by this time next year, you'll embrace a son, and the word for embrace is Habakkuk, which is the verb of Habakkuk. And so some people said, oh, maybe that's who he was. And again, there's nothing that says that that's true. It's interesting, but it's all essentially fan fiction. So that's all we know about this prophet. So when did he prophesy? We know from the book itself that Habakkuk lived and prophesied before the Babylonian invasion of Judah. But throughout his book, Babylon doesn't seem to be that much of an imminent threat yet. So most scholars kind of place this book somewhere between 606 and 604 BC. And so if you think about it, Habakkuk would have most likely witnessed the fall of Nineveh in 612 BC. He would have witnessed the Battle of Haran, where King Josiah dies, in 609 BC. And Habakkuk very well could have lived to see the exile. He could have very well, we don't know for sure, but he could have been one of the people who were captured by Babylon and taken to exile to Babylon. So what was going on then, right, in Judah during this time? I want to remind you, right, that, and if you've been tracking with us, you'll know this, the kingdom of Israel split into two, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And so now at this point, Israel has been conquered. They're defeated. They're off the map right now. Assyria wiped them out. And now we have this southern kingdom of Judah. And Judah was incredibly wicked under King Manasseh and King Amon. They worshipped Baal in all of the high places. They did child sacrifices to Molech. They dedicated their horses to the sun god. We know that the temple fell into disrepair and ruin. And then Josiah became king. And most of us know the story of Josiah. He becomes king when he's 8, and then he finds the book of the law. And what happens under the reign of Josiah is like almost this mini revival happens. Josiah restored the temple. He reinstated the feast of Passover. And so many people who lived in Josiah's reign, especially the prophets, they would have thought, hey, maybe Judah's turning itself around. Maybe God won't send judgment because look, we're going back to the law and we're following Josiah's reforms. So King Josiah is killed in 609 BC in battle, and Judah immediately falls back into sin and wickedness and idolatry. And I mean immediately, like it wasn't, like it happened. As soon as he died, the next king was there and they just reinstated all of the idol worship and all of these terrible things. So at the end of the 7th century, many people in the Middle East were left reeling and disillusioned. There was rapid political change, there was international turmoil, there was bloody military battles, and there was this growing rebellion among Judah that the demands of the covenant are just too hard. The vast majority of people that lived in Judah, they said, the demands of the covenant are ridiculous. We can't possibly do this. That's when Habakkuk lived. And so what we're going to see in this book is it's almost as if Habakkuk is looking out at the landscape and the climate going on in Judah, and he is complaining to God about it. So verse 2, this is Habakkuk's first complaint. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. So here is the prophet's first complaint. And I think when we first read that, my gut reaction is, you can't talk to God like that. I mean, these are some pretty serious complaints that Habakkuk is bringing before God. What he's saying essentially is he's disappointed that God doesn't seem to be answering his prayers. He says, God, I'm crying out to you and you aren't listening to me. You aren't saving me from violence. God, why are you making me look at sin and wickedness all around without doing anything? Your law is paralyzed. There's no justice in the land. So he's saying, God, you're not just. And the justice that comes forth in the land is perverted. So essentially, here's what Habakkuk's big complaint is. God, there's so much violence. There's so much sin. There's so much wickedness in Judah. And you're not doing anything about it. Like, why, God? Why do you seem so indifferent and so insensitive? God, you're letting sin go unpunished, and therefore, what Habakkuk is inferring is you are not a just God. God, why are you letting Judah get away with all of this sin and evil and oppression? That's Habakkuk's first complaint. Look at how God answers him in verse 5. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press loudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. So here essentially is God's answer to Habakkuk's complaint. First of all, I want you to notice that God doesn't dispute anything that Habakkuk says, which is super interesting. He doesn't come back to Habakkuk and go, wait, it's not as bad as it seems. Like, don't pin this on me. He doesn't try and justify anything. What he's saying is, Habakkuk, your analysis of what's going on in Judah is correct. God agrees with the prophet. There's strife and violence and sin and idolatry. God is well aware of that. So essentially, Habakkuk says, God, there is all of this sin and injustice and evil, and you aren't doing anything about it. And God's answer to him is, I am doing something about it. Habakkuk, I'm already beginning to answer your prayers for justice. You just don't realize it. God is saying, I'm not indifferent or insensitive or idle. I'm already at work to discipline Judah. And then in verse 5, I mean, God says, look among the nations and see, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if I told you. Like, God is saying, Habakkuk, I'm already working behind the scenes, but if I told you what I was doing, you wouldn't even believe me. Verse 6, behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans. So what does that mean? The Chaldeans essentially is another name for Babylon. And so think about that. God says, Habakkuk, I am doing something about all of the injustice and evil and sin going on in Judah. I'm raising up Babylon, that great nation, as a way to punish Judah for all of her wickedness. And then in verses 6 to 11, God essentially describes this great and powerful nation of Babylon. And we're just going to fly over this, but basically he describes them. They're bitter and hasty. They march through the earth and they take dwellings that don't belong to them. They're dreaded and fearsome. They've decided their own justice and dignity, meaning they decide what is just and not just, not some outside force deciding for them. Horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than wolves, flying like eagles to devour. They come for violence. They all face forward, which is a picture of armies all marching in the same direction. They gather up captives like sand. They scoff at kings. They laugh at fortresses. They pile up earth and take it, which is super interesting. How they would siege different fortresses and cities is that they would just literally pile up a massive mound of earth and then just walk up it to battle the city. That's what they would do. So it's as if God is saying, Babylon just laughs at your fortresses. They'll just push a bunch of earth up and walk up and overtake them. And they're guilty men who worship their own might as their God. So, I mean, that is quite a description of a violent, idolatrous, wicked nation. The Babylonians rivaled Assyria and just how awful they were. And it's very interesting when you look at the rise and fall of Babylon, in terms of nations, it happened very quickly. You have a virtually non-existent entity, which ends up conquering the old capital of Assyria in 614, conquers Nineveh in 612, conquers Haran in 610, routs the armies of Pharaoh in 605 BC, and then becomes the powerhouse of the Middle East. And yet, by 539 BC... so some 65 years later, they're wiped out by Cyrus of Persia. Like, that's fast. If you love history, that's fascinating. And here's why. Most historians believe that Babylon was quite reckless in what they would do. And you kind of get that. They would just march out and battle and conquer and take all the stuff. But essentially, they spread themselves too thin, and they were an easy target to take over. And so you kind of get that description in God's answer, that they're just swift and they do things really fast and recklessly, and that was actually to their own demise. So what we see is Babylon is this incredibly violent, oppressive, idolatrous nation, and that's God's answer to Habakkuk. He says, I am dealing with Judah's sin and rebellion and their injustice, and how I'm dealing with that is by raising up Babylon to conquer them. So here's Habakkuk's response, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet, so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Like, isn't that, that's so good. Habakkuk first said, his first complaint is, God, why don't you do anything about the evil injustice in Judah? And God answers, I am doing something. I'm raising up Babylon to conquer Judah. And Habakkuk's response is, God, I don't really like that. I don't like that you're doing it that way. Like, God's answer to Habakkuk's first objection leaves him even more perplexed and bewildered. And I mean, verses 12 and 13, it really sums up his wrestling. First of all, he acknowledges the sovereignty of God. He says, oh God, you're from everlasting, you're the Holy One. And then he says, you've ordained Babylon as a judgment, you've established them for reproof. But then verse 13, he says, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? See, Habakkuk's real issue is this: God, how can you use Babylon, who is far more wicked and evil than Judah, to punish Judah? Right? God answers him, I'm doing something. I'm going to use Babylon. And Habakkuk says, how on earth could you use Babylon? They're way worse than we are. And that's true. Sinful as they were, Judah's wickedness was dwarfed by the atrocities that Babylon committed. And so what we see is Habakkuk is wrestling, God, how on earth can you raise up a nation so evil to accomplish your purposes? Like, really, God? Babylon's going to come and conquer us, and you're just going to let them get away with all of their evil and atrocities? And so Habakkuk says that, you know, what are we, like fish of the sea? We're just helpless, and the net's going to come, and the king of Babylon's just going to drive us or drag us away, and then you're just going to let Babylon keep living in luxury while we suffer? Verse 17, really, is Babylon just going to keep on gathering nations forever and killing us? And I love it. In chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk, he sounds to me like a very stubborn man. And he says, I'm going to go sit on the tower, and I'm going to wait, and God is going to answer me. Isn't that so good? He says, I'm going to wait. This is my complaint. I'm going to wait on the tower, and I'm going to see what God says. So here's God's response, verse 2. And the Lord answered me. Write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So first of all, isn't it just amazing that God doesn't rail against Habakkuk for his accusations? Like, God doesn't come down and say, how dare you question me? Who do you think you are? How dare you accuse me, Habakkuk? What we see, look at that, the Lord answered me. Like, that is such a gracious and fatherly love that we see in God's response to Habakkuk. God has every right to say, who do you think you are? But he comes down and Habakkuk says, I'm going to wait and God will answer me. And the very next verse says, and God answered me. And what does God say? He says, write this down. Make it really plain so that runners can run it out and spread the word. Essentially, what he's saying is, Habakkuk, I love this, like make sure it's neat writing. Write it in big font so that people can take it and answer this question that people have. And essentially, God says, the vision waits for its appointed time. It won't lie. It will come. It won't delay. If it seems slow, keep waiting. Meaning, God is saying, Habakkuk, I'm going to deal with Babylon in my appointed time. Contrary to Habakkuk's second complaint, no, God is not going to use Babylon to punish Judah and then just let them carry on in their wickedness and evil forever. At the appointed time, God will deal with Babylon. And it might not be when Habakkuk thinks. And then in verse 4 and 5, he talks about the king of Babylon, puffed up, not upright. They were drunks and arrogant, full of greed, and Babylon was gathering all the nations to himself. And then God contrasts that with the end of verse 4. But the righteous shall live by his faith. See, God says to Habakkuk, you can't possibly understand my sovereignty and providence among the nations and how I'm going to use Babylon for my purposes and still hold them accountable for their evil, but it will come. Be patient. If it seems slow, Habakkuk, keep waiting for it. And what he says is the righteous person is someone who learns how to live in that tension of faith in God, even when it doesn't necessarily make sense. So there is a lot of rich theology in this first chapter that we really need to wrestle with. Habakkuk is asking questions that I think if we're all honest, we have all wrestled with these questions. If we're honest, I think all of us have asked questions like that. God, why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? God, why do you allow these certain things to happen? And many of us, we look, big picture at the world. God, why is there war and bloodshed and famine and child trafficking and all of these things across the globe? Why do you allow those things to happen? God, are you distant or are you insincere or are you disconnected with what's going on in the world? So we ask those questions big picture, but then listen, if you're honest, you ask that even personally. Like, God, why did my dad have to get cancer and die? Like, God, why has my mom been suffering with pain for 20 years? God, why did my loved one, why did my child die? God, why is my son or daughter living in rebellion against you? And so we think big picture and we ask these hard questions, but then personally we go, God, why is there so much evil and injustice and suffering? Why, even when COVID hit, Christians were asking those questions. God, why would you allow or cause a worldwide pandemic? God, why would you allow or cause nations' economies to collapse? And so what's going on when we ask questions like that is it's a human being with a finite, limited mind trying to pin down and explain an infinite and limitless, eternal God's plan and purpose and actions in the world. And oftentimes, I want the answer to fit in a nice, neatly wrapped package that I fully understand. And that's what Habakkuk wanted. God, why are you doing this? Why are you allowing evil and injustice? And he says, I'm going to deal with it. And then Habakkuk says, that doesn't fit what I want. Like that doesn't fit my paradigm. That doesn't fit my worldview that you would use Babylon to deal with us. That's not the answer I'm looking for, God. And so I think we're the same. I want the answer to evil and suffering to just fit so nicely in my North American worldview. Now, here's what happens. Every single time Christians or denominations attempt to very neatly explain suffering and evil alongside the existence of God, if that question could be answered in a way that makes 100% sense, it's usually heresy and not biblical. So let me give you some examples of this. You know, some people have said, well, evil and suffering exist, so perhaps God is not all good. And maybe God is the author of evil and the inventor of evil. And we know that that's actually not true biblically. We know, and I've listed in the life group questions a bunch of passages. We know from passages after passage after passage that God is wholly good. He is an all good God. There is no evil in him. And he is sovereign and in control. And we also know that he is not held accountable for the evil that takes place in the world. So some have tried to explain evil and suffering, and they said, well, maybe there's evil and suffering, and maybe God is not providential or in control of everything. So God doesn't cause those things. You know, maybe Satan does. But do you realize when you make that statement, you've just said that Satan and God are equal in power, which is not true biblically. And yet it's this idea that, you know, and I've heard some preachers say, well, God's sovereign, but he's not in control. There's a difference, which just logically makes no sense and biblically makes no sense. But it's a way to kind of to try and, humanly speaking, make an explanation that lets God off the hook almost, or makes an excuse for why there's evil and suffering. I've heard one recently that is very popular. People say, well, God can't give what he doesn't have. It's a very popular saying, and I've heard it, you know, well, and especially when COVID came out, well, Christians were reeling, going, you know, why is God allowing this or causing this? And many pastors said, oh, no, God's not doing this. God can't give COVID because he doesn't have COVID, or God can't give cancer because he doesn't have cancer. Logically and biblically, that makes no sense. It's catchy, but it makes zero sense. And here's why. Oftentimes, the same people who say that then say, God wants me to have a better car and a better house. Really? Does God drive a car? Does God live in a house? He can't give what he doesn't have. It makes no sense. But it was a way to kind of defend God. I think in all of those examples, it's because we as humans think that we have to be God's PR people. Don't worry, it's not what it sounds like. God is not like that. So here's a quote from Charles Spurgeon. It's so good. He says, a great many learned men are defending the gospel. No doubt it's a very proper and right thing to do, yet I always notice that when there are most books of that kind, it's because the gospel itself is not being preached. Suppose a number of persons were to take it into their heads that they had to defend a lion, a full-grown king of beasts. There he is in the cage, and here come all of the soldiers of the army to fight for him. Well, I should suggest to them, if they would not object and feel that it was humbling to them, that they should kindly stand back and open the door and let the lion out. I believe that would be the best way of defending him, for he would take care of himself. And the best apology for the gospel is to let the gospel out. Never mind about defending Deuteronomy or the whole of the Pentateuch. Preach Jesus Christ and him crucified. Let the lion out and see who will dare to approach him. The lion of the tribe of Judah will soon drive away all of his adversaries. So, I mean, that's just so good. Charles Spurgeon is just bang on. Because what I think he's meaning is, so even take the idea of evil and suffering. We often, people object to God's existence and the reality of evil and suffering, and we as Christians scramble, trying to like, we got to make God look good and defend him. And Spurgeon would say, really, the lion of the tribe of Judah, you want to defend God? Just let God out of the cage. God can take care of himself. I mean, just think about Habakkuk's questioning of God. God, why is there so much evil and injustice in Judah? Why are you letting this happen? Why aren't you doing something about it? And God answers him, I am doing something about it. I'm raising up Babylon to punish Judah. And Habakkuk's response is, no, that's not right. God, how could you in your goodness raise up an even more evil nation than Judah to punish the sovereign rule and redemptive purposes of God? Look at some of these passages. Amos 3:6. Is a trumpet blown in a city and the people are not afraid? Does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it? These are rhetorical questions, right? And so Amos is essentially asking, would disaster come to a city unless God had did it? And the answer is, well, of course not. If a city comes to disaster, it's because God has done it. Now, we don't like that, right? That kind of makes you bristle a little bit. So Isaiah 45, this is God speaking. I form light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. Notice, God doesn't say, I make well-being and Satan creates calamity. God says, I am the Lord and I do all of these things. Lamentations 3, who has spoken and it came to pass unless the Lord commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and bad come? Why should a living man complain, a man about the punishment of his sins? If you remember the book of Job, and the accuser comes before God, and there's this back and forth, and God says, well, have you tried to test my servant Job? And if you know the story, Job's family dies, and his kids die, and his crops are taken, and his livestock are taken, and his health is taken. And in Job 2, it says this, then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Lovely woman. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Look at this. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So all of this suffering is happening to Job, and his wife comes to him and says, you still think you're innocent? Just curse God and die already. And Job says, no, you're speaking like a foolish person. Should we receive good from God, but not also receive evil? And it says, in all of this, Job didn't sin with his lips. It wasn't a sin for him to say that. 1 Samuel 16, now the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him. A harmful spirit from the Lord. Right? And this was not, this. If you read the story, this was punishment for Saul's disobedience and sinfulness. And I mean, listen, we could go on and on and on and on. Passage after passage that says that God is in control and sovereign over everything that happens, and that evil and calamity don't exist apart from his sovereign control. There's nothing that happens that God goes, man, I didn't see that coming. Like, he is sovereign over everything that happens, including evil and calamity. Even in our passage in Habakkuk 1, verse 6, God says, he is the one who is raising up the Babylonians. Like, why did the Babylonians rise to power like they did? Because God willed that they would, to accomplish his divine purposes. So to answer the question of evil and suffering, you have to be okay to sit in some tension. It's with so many things in Christianity, there's just this posture where you sit in a little bit of tension. God is sovereign over everything that happens. He raises up Babylon for his purposes to punish Judah, and Habakkuk answers back, how could you use such a wicked and evil nation? And God's answer is, don't worry, I will deal with Babylon in due time. And so God is sovereign, and he's in control, and he uses and causes everything that happens to accomplish his will and his purpose in human history, and yet he still holds nations like Babylon and Assyria responsible for their actions. And we unpacked this a bit when we talked about God's providence, that God is providentially working in everything. So he raises up Babylon, but Babylon can't go, hey, you can't punish us. You were just using us. No, Babylon is still held accountable for their evil and injustice. So God does not invent evil or do evil in anything that he does. And see, this is where a lot of people say, well, that's just convenient, isn't it? You're just letting God off the hook for evil and suffering, which could not be farther from the truth. God puts himself very much on the hook for human evil and suffering in the person and work of Jesus. So to say that the biblical view of holding God's sovereignty and the reality of evil intention somehow lets God off the hook, it's a misunderstanding of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Jesus being nailed to a cross was God literally putting himself on the hook for human evil and suffering? Like God himself, Jesus, God in the flesh, nailed to a tree, and the sinfulness and wickedness and evil of mankind was put on him, and the punishment of God, his wrath against all evil and sinfulness and evil doing was poured out onto Jesus. We go, what kind of God would do this for us? So here's what we do when we wrestle with suffering and injustice and evil. We might not know the definite answer to why God is allowing it and causing it. But we know what the answer can't be. The answer can't be that God doesn't love you. So listen, when you look at the world and you see evil and injustice and suffering, and when you look at your own life and you see evil happening and injustice and suffering in your own life, listen, you might not ever get the answer why this is happening, but you can always know what the answer isn't. It isn't that God doesn't love you. I mean, he made that abundantly clear when Jesus was crucified to a tree. So we don't know what the answer is, maybe, but we always know what the answer isn't. It can't be that God is distant and cold and unloving and insincere. It can't be that he himself is evil. The cross proves all of those statements wrong. So part of living in this tension of not fully understanding God's will and purposes and actions throughout human history is what it means to live by faith. And God says that in Habakkuk 2. He tells Habakkuk, he says, write this down. The vision will come to pass. If it's slow, wait for it. It's going to happen. It won't delay. And then he says in verse 4, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Now what's interesting is that this verse is quoted 3 times in the New Testament. And each time it shows a different aspect of what it means. So in Romans 1, Paul says this. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. See, in Romans 1, what Paul does is he takes Habakkuk 2 verse 4 and he kind of appropriates it. And he says, this is the foundation for the entire gospel. So Paul says, salvation is through faith in Jesus. The righteous shall live by faith means the righteous are those who trust God's righteousness as their own. It's not as if, well, if you can kind of make yourself righteous on your own, well, then you can live by faith. No, we live by faith by trusting in a righteousness that doesn't belong to us. So Paul says that verse in Habakkuk 2 verse 4 is the foundation of everything that we believe. And then in Galatians 3, Paul quotes it again. He says, all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, cursed be everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them. Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for, and here it is, the righteous shall live by faith. So Paul in Romans says, faith is the foundation of everything that we believe in. And then he goes so far to say, you can't even achieve righteousness through the law. There is no salvation in the law. There is no righteousness through the law. Salvation is being declared righteous through faith in what Jesus has done. And then in Hebrews 10, the author of Hebrew quotes Habakkuk as well, for you have no need of endurance, or for you have need of endurance rather, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. What the author of Hebrews is saying is that as a Christian, you're going to suffer as you wait for Jesus to come back. But it's the righteous ones who live by faith. So isn't that interesting? In Habakkuk, the people of Judah were going to suffer because they deserved it. It was punishment. And yet the remnant who lived in Judah, who still loved God, they were told the righteous will live by faith. Your faith is going to get you through that. And then in Hebrews, Christians are suffering not because of any punishment, but it's just because of the reality of following Jesus. And yet the author of Hebrews says the same thing. The righteous one lives by faith. You live in faith that Jesus is going to come back. See, God tells Habakkuk that his will and his purpose and his timing with Judah and Babylon, he says, Habakkuk, you wouldn't even believe me if I told you what I was doing. Essentially, like, you can't even comprehend what I'm doing, God says. And you're not meant to nail it down and tie it perfectly in a pretty little package. A mature faith, right? God says, my people are people who live by faith in what they don't understand. And a mature faith trusts humbly but persistently in God's design for establishing righteousness in the earth. It takes faith to wait patiently for God and for his plan to unfold. But the righteous, God calls them, are those who believe that even if they don't understand it. It's people who by faith say, I don't understand why this is happening, but I know that God is accomplishing something. That kind of faith is a faith that just continues trusting in God, clinging to God's promises, especially in dark days. So I want to encourage you, it is absolutely appropriate to come to God with your hard questions. Habakkuk brings very serious complaints to God. And he's not the only example in Scripture. I think it's almost a third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. Psalms where the psalmist is crying out, God, where are you? Like, why are you forsaking me, God? What's going on? God, are you going to hide your face from me forever? And I know we look at that, and many of us, we go, well, you can't talk to God like that. But that's not true. The biblical example is people in deep sorrow and lament coming to God and going, God, why are you doing this? So the Christian worldview allows room for you to ask these questions. But hear this, and I want to speak truthfully, and I do not want to sugarcoat it or lie to you. You might not get the answer that you want. You are free to question God and bring your complaints to him, but you might not get the answer that fits perfectly into your finite way of thinking. God might just say to you, you wouldn't even believe if I showed you what I was doing behind the scenes. So I think, like, personally, we need to wrestle with this. And I know, I overuse this example, but my mom has suffered for 20 years. And many of us have cried out, God, why? This is not fair. And we haven't gotten an answer in 20 years. And so, listen, you might not get an answer of why suffering and evil happen. But you can wrestle with God, and part of living by faith is that when things don't make sense, you actually rest in the character of God and who he is, and by faith you trust that God is good and he is sovereign and he's in control and he knows what he's doing, even if I don't get it. And we don't want to jump ahead, but this is eventually the conclusion that Habakkuk comes to. Habakkuk comes to the conclusion, God is sovereign and in control, and he's good, and he's loving, and I don't get what's going on, but I trust him because I want to live by faith. So I want to encourage you, part of being a Christian, part of living by faith, it's not a blind faith, but you come to a certain point in your Christian walk where you do have to just by faith say, I don't get it, but I trust you, Jesus. And I think one of the examples, one of the arenas that this happens is dealing with evil and suffering. We want to explain it away. We want to have it fit nice and neat into our worldview. But the Bible's answer to evil and suffering is God is good and he is sovereign and you need to trust him. And so that is my prayer for you, that you and I, that we would be people who live by faith even in dark days when maybe we don't understand fully what's going on. So Jesus, I just thank you for your word. I thank you that some 2,600 years ago, a prophet named Habakkuk dealt with the exact same things that we wrestle with. And God, we look at the world and we see much evil and suffering and injustice, and we look at our own lives and see evil and suffering and injustice. And I know that our response much of the time is like Habakkuk. Why, God? Why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this to happen? It doesn't make sense. And so, God, first, I thank you that you are a God who welcomes our lament, that the biblical worldview is, as Christians are called, to express deep sorrow and lament over evil and injustice. I thank you that you invite us to question you. And yet, God, I know I am so much like Habakkuk. You often answer me and I go, nah, I don't like that answer. It doesn't fit with how I would do things. So God, forgive us. Forgive me when my response is like that. And so God, I thank you that in the midst of evil and suffering, you are sovereign and you are in control and you are holy, good, and loving. I thank you that even when we might not get answers for why there's evil and injustice, we know beyond the shadow of a doubt what the answer can't be. It can't be that you don't love us. It just can't. The cross proves that wrong. So the answer to our suffering and evil in the world can't be that you're distant or that you're unloving or that you're cold towards us, because the cross proves all of those statements wrong, that you are incredibly close to us, that you are incredibly loving, that you literally took the evil and pain and suffering of the world on yourself, being nailed to a cross and the wrath of God being poured out onto you for us. So God, I pray, I know that there are people in this room that are walking through incredible pain and suffering. And if we're not, it'll come because it's inevitable. And so God, I pray that you would strengthen those of us who are suffering, that we would be people who live by faith, that we would ask hard questions of you knowing that you can handle it, but that we would come to a conclusion that we trust your attributes, we trust what you've done on the cross, and we just rest in faith that you are a good God and you are accomplishing your purposes in the world. So God, that is only a response that the Holy Spirit has to do in us. And so would you do that work? Help us to be people of faith. And I pray, God, that you would just strengthen us as we go through pain and evil and suffering, and that we would just rest in who you are and what you're doing in the world. And so we just pray all of this in your name, Jesus. Amen.